Welcome, my distinguished listeners, to another episode of Son of a Pitch. I'm your host, Michael Cuenca. And as we navigate the intricate corridors of life, the mysteries of the universe, and the ever-evolving world of entrepreneurship, today's episode promises to be a beacon of insight. Now imagine you're at a crossroads, one path leading to a venture that could redefine an industry, and the other to a venture that promises quick but shallow rewards. To guide us through these complex choices, we are honored today to have Gyan Sira. Gyan is not just a seasoned veteran in technology and venture capital, he's a thinker who challenges conventional wisdom and dares to ask the questions that many shy away from. We'll start by delving into the psychology of investment, dissecting the cognitive processes that guide us at these crossroads. But choices have consequences, and not just for the bottom line, but for society at large. We'll explore the ethical dimensions that hover like guardian angels or lurking shadows over investment decisions. Yet, even as we chase success, the specter of mental health looms large, often relegated to hushed conversations. But today, we bring it to the forefront, unmasking the silent crisis within the tech industry. And as we journey through these complex terrains, we'll also confront the mirrors we sometimes avoid, the quest for external validation, a force that can either propel us to new heights or plunge us into existential crises. So whether you're an investor scrutinizing the next big thing or a founder steering the ship through turbulent waters, this episode is your compass. Let's embark on this intellectual odyssey with Gyan Sira. And a very good day to you, fine listeners in podcast land. This is Michael Cuenca here at Son of a Pitch, and I am joined today with someone very special for you guys. Someone that via the networks, via the interwebs, via the LinkedIn miscellaneousness, we've come to get to know each other a little bit better. Gyan Sira is the lovely fellow joining me today. Without further ado, I figure, Gyan, who better to introduce yourself than yourself? Why don't you tell the peeps in this in the radio land and slash video advertising miscellaneousness that will happen afterwards? Who the hell are you?
Sure, yeah. So I'll go through the whole shebang of my story. I've been in the tech industry for over a decade now. Dude. My journey really started probably when I was. Well, I say it was when I was 12 years old. I my mum asked me what I wanted to do for a living in the future. And I said I wanted to change the world for the better. Very much in naivety. But that did stick with me, right? I still think about that to this day. So then that kind of kept me going from probably age of 12. And then really from the age of about 18 or 19, when I was very much anti-authoritarian and very much, you know, trying to keep myself away from what, you know, the normal people do. And that's where I really fell into entrepreneurship and kind of just fell in love with it. So from the age of 18, I started a few companies, not within the tech sphere, you know, doing just stuff within the kind of student stuff, anything from club nights to hiring services to an amalgamation of different other things. And it was really my first foray into entrepreneurship, and I was hooked basically from then. After that,
so,
I then
so partying was your foray into entrepreneurship.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah,
what a better start, man.
It was an avenue. It was an avenue to it, definitely. And then actually, when kind of my last few years of uni, I actually did start to think about, you know, more within the tech sphere. So I started a company that was basically trying to be eBay for students, as well as. And basically trying to digitalize the Facebook marketplace, if you think about it from that point, actually before Facebook even had a marketplace. And you know, failed miserably at it, as you'd expect from a very young person. Didn't know what to do, didn't know how to code, didn't know how to do anything really. So it failed. But it was an amazing learning, and it just made me even more excited to be in the journey. I then actually moved to Canada, where funny enough to be a ski instructor, but I actually ended up starting two biotech companies out there. So then that was an amazing experience. Spent about 3 years building those two companies, raised $16 million, hired about 16 scientists and got to kind of Series A with those two. And that was an amazing experience for me, coming from, you know, having no experience to then, you know, building out these companies from not even having a name to, you know, fully functioning companies. And then at that point, I was decided I want to come back to the UK. Okay. And, you know, for me, it was always the same thing. I knew I wanted to be a VC-backed founder at that point. And I knew that, you know, at least in the CEO role. And I really, you know, I thought that was like what I was meant to do. So when I came back to the UK,
you thought you were meant to be a VC backed founder.
Yeah. I thought that was the correct.
It's awfully specific.
Yeah. Yeah. It is definitely. I do agree. But yeah, so I thought that, right. I thought that was what I was going to do.
Okay.
And I didn't, at that point I was, you know, it wasn't like I was a 40-year-old who'd done this everything before. I knew I still need to learn more and I need to build a network, et cetera. So for me, I thought, okay, maybe I'll try my hand at a VC then, you know, to see the other side. Mull it out for a couple of years, see, yeah, you know, what makes it good and what makes it bad, and then also build my network. So then I ended up joining a company called Octopus Ventures, which is one of Europe's largest venture capital firms. Joined the Octopus health team there. Yeah. And
it's a cool venture firm, I gotta say.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing people and amazing supportive as well when I left as well. But yeah, so I joined the health team there. We went from basically a standing still start to now the most active health investor. It was part of $150 million worth of investments whilst I was there. So it was an amazing experience. But I think about it from this point, I was probably eight years into tech at that point, both in terms of my startups and then also in VC. Mm. And, you know, I had this whole journey of I want to be a VC-backed founder, you know, for that whole time. And, you know, a decade plus at that point. And it was only when I was at Octopus and I saw all of the portfolio companies and saw the, you know, the founders that were successful and the ones that weren't. And then thinking about myself as well, what I'm good and what I like to invest into, etc.
Yeah,
it made me realize I didn't want to be a VC-backed founder, or that I wasn't meant to be one.
But what changed? Like, why did you want to be a VC-backed founder in the first?
Yeah,
place?
I think I was.
Like,
I think I was doing it for the wrong reasons. That was why.
What were those?
Ego, ego, and
you wanted to close like deals, external, like close funding, yeah, and have people know about it.
I wanted to be on TechCrunch, and I wanted to have, and it was like external validation of like, oh, I've done something. Rather than where it should be, which is, you know, I've got this massive problem that I know of, I want to solve, and I'm going to spend 10 years trying to do it.
Yes.
So I realized I just had the wrong intentions. And then secondly, it wasn't the kind of lifestyle I wanted to build either, in terms of, you know, I wanted entrepreneurship to be more of a freedom gaining during the process rather than freedom gaining at the end, or, you know, and for me, it wasn't, you know, I knew I wouldn't love the process of doing a VC-backed company.
But if you wanted to be a VC-backed founder, why did you join a VC firm?
Pardon?
If you wanted to be a VC-backed founder, why did you join a VC firm? Isn't that the wrong side of the table?
No, it's actually a really good side of the table, because you build out, you can understand what's good or bad. You understand exactly how to get funding. And then also you build out your network. So, you know, there's a lot of VCs that, you know, go into VC and then go to entrepreneurship and then go the other way around as well. So for me, it was very much I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point. When I joined VC, I was like, I want to be a VC-backed founder, but I haven't got, you know, an idea, or I haven't got a passion, et cetera, that I want to go into. So let me just do this for a few years and see what it was. That was probably a writing on the wall when I was deciding that, to be fair. But yeah, so that was really hard for me. It kind of, you know, my whole world kind of crumbled in front of me, because this kind of North Star that I thought I had wasn't really a North Star, and I had to kind of push myself to a different thing. So then I was, then I basically for 6 months was just kind of trying all these different things. And in my spare time, I was helping founders basically for free, just because I like doing it. I enjoy doing it and I have fun doing it. And then one of my friends, he said to me, you know, you're doing this stuff for free. You're helping these founders. Why don't you try and make something from this? And that's pretty much what's now I've now done for 2 years, which is, you know, helping founders fundraise. And you know, I'm deeply passionate about it, and it's great. And now that's what I do.
That's pretty awesome, man. Now, so like being at Octopus and being in the VC side of things, and especially in the last couple of years, what you've been doing, you must have seen like a crap ton of best in class pitch decks, and entrepreneurs presenting them to you quite well. Have you ever seen a pitch deck that was like so crazy convincing, but you still decided not to invest in the company? Or they still decided, or they still didn't get investment? Like, have you ever seen something that's like, holy shit,
I think,
it's so good?
You know, a pitch deck is never about getting investment. It's, I want to meet this person. So, most companies that I even met had really good pitch decks, but I didn't invest into them. You know, I'd invest into, I don't know the exact number, but probably 1%, if that, of companies I met, I would, you know, we'd actually invest into. And a lot of, you know, probably 50% of them had pretty good decks. So, you know, decks are a tool to get a meeting, and that's what they are. And, you know, a tool for you to understand or give yourself clarity on what you're trying to build. But from then on, it's not about the deck. It's about the person, you know, the person to person connection and building relationships and getting that investor excited by what you're trying to build, which doesn't come from a pitch deck. It comes from, you know, the actual person pitching it.
Yeah, you mentioned that a lot in some of your posts and some of the content you have on your site as well. You mentioned that investors back founders, not companies, essentially. And do you think maybe that this creates a kind of bias towards a certain kind of founder?
Yeah, no, 100%. That is a big problem. And you can't get past that, unfortunately. Well, people keep trying, and hopefully they do. But
yeah,
look.
Well, what kind of founder is typically the ones that get through the gates there?
Well, it's not all the time, right? But, you know.
Sure.
More extroverted person who can pitch better is usually a little bit better in that regard. However, that is changing. I know investors are thinking differently, especially if you're in different stages, sectors rather. So, or, you know, business models, for example, a consumer founder probably should be pretty extroverted and be able to pitch well, whereas say a deep tech founder shouldn't necessarily. So, you know, when we were looking at deep tech founders, we didn't really care if they were good at pitching or not. We cared about, you know, the product, what they were building, the team they were building, and all those kind of things. And then also if they were bringing on people who would be and end up leading in a much better way, right? That's common within deep tech, right? You can't get away from that. Same with kind of health tech, et cetera. But that being said, you know, people always say, oh, that's unfair and there's a bias, but look, life's unfair. You can't get away from it. And you've got to also look at it from the other way, right? There's a reason why they do that. There's a reason why they have to do it by the founders and nothing else. And that's because, you know, this isn't traditional private equity. This isn't a company with, you know, your company's not going to have 5 years of cash flow with profits and it's all stable and you know exactly what's going to happen, et cetera. These are companies that are less than 2 or 3 years old. They're trying to fundamentally change a market. You don't know what the market's like. And, you know, there's three things on that. You know, one is this is everything is up to chance. You don't know what's going to happen. The second one is, you know, everything is unknown. You don't know what the future's like. You know, a great example of that was a company that we invested into at Octopus called Cabbie, which was before my time. But Cabbie was an app which allowed consumers to connect with minicab drivers. And Octopus invested into them in a really big Series A, thought it was going to do amazingly well. But little did they know that there was a small company called Uber being built in San Francisco. And 2 years later, Uber came to England and absolutely decimated Cabbie because it was a much better business model. And from a growth point of view, now you don't know that's going to happen. And you can never really back a business model or an idea because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. And, you know, the last one is fundamentally every single decision goes back to the CEOs. Again, if I use Cabbie as an example, you know, I never met the CEO, so I can't really say, but, you know, maybe if Cabbie had different CEOs or, you know, different leaders and they were more agile and they actually changed to the Uber model, maybe you'd still have Cabbie right now. So everything always just comes back to the founder. That's the only way that you can really have a controllable understanding of whether a company is going to succeed or not. And when it comes to that point of view, there are just points of a founder that you need to have for them to succeed, which is very common for every single unicorn founder that's ever been. There's very common traits between them because that's just a common thing.
So like, what kind of things do you see in common with these kinds of companies?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there's a lot. There's not a single one.
No, of course, in the myriad of different characteristics, what are some of the right combinations?
Wrapping my head around all of them, there's a lot. But, you know, right? I think that the major ones are an ability to hire well and build a culture. That's one of the most important parts. Again, you know, like I said, everything's kind of based around the founders. Well, then the next kind of rung behind that is the team they build.
Okay.
The second one is the ability to execute. The biggest problem with any company is they just don't execute and take action. The third one is, unless you're a seasoned entrepreneur, which, you know, 90% of the time companies that get funded, they're not, you know, founders who've had $2 billion exits or anything. Most of them are either first time founders or second time founders who haven't had a massive exit.
Yeah.
Coachability is a massive one because you can't really ever learn how to be a CEO. You can't take a course on how to be a CEO. It's very much, I've got to be in the job. So you can then, you know, but having a coachability personality of, okay, I need to learn this thing. I'm going to get as many people to help me as I can. And when I am having a relationship with my investor, they can help me with this regard. Empathy is another one. And I would say those are the kind of four main ones. I'd say the fifth one as well is communicative. And what I mean by that is twofold. One is communicative in terms of, are we actually able to communicate properly? Are you going to tell me all the information that's needed? Are you going to give it in a timely manner? Are you going to hide anything from me? But then secondly on it is being data driven within your communication. So an investor is really worried that, you know, they invest into a company and then they don't really know what's happening in the company. But if a founder is data driven and says, look, this is exactly the numbers that are happening, and I can tell you every month what's happening. A great example is a company in the Octopus portfolio where they literally have a live data sheet of everything from the financials to sales to cohorts to everything that you know, the person in the portfolio who's a director on the board of directors can literally see that every single day change. So whenever they want to check it, they don't have to go to the founder and ask, can you send me this stuff and wait 2 weeks? It's live. They can do it. It's that kind of stuff where you can be data driven and communicate that in the best way. That's really, really powerful.
That's pretty cool. Now the empathy thing, you know, so I'm kind of at a crossroads. So I can totally understand. I can empathize with the need for empathy in setting up a team. But isn't there, and this is maybe me playing a little bit of devil's advocate, isn't there some merit to a little bit of sociopathy, you know, the ability to just stay so super focused on the vision, on the goal, on getting shit done, that you kind of have to turn the volume down on everything else? And unfortunately, that sometimes might mean not listening to people you in a friendly setting might otherwise be listening to. Like, what's the balance between
I do think there is a sense of that, you know, sociopaths are more successful in most things anyway, right? And then more common is to be CEOs as well. So yeah, I don't disagree. Maybe empathy was the wrong word. What I mean by empathy
no,
is,
I don't think it was a wrong word. I'm just, there's some bandwidth.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with this. You know, there's a parts of being a founder where you can't really be empathetic and you have to make hard decisions. What I mean by empathy is really, you know, maybe empathy again is the wrong word. Maybe I'm thinking more of, what's it called? Emotional EQ, right? Emotional,
emotional intelligence.
Quotient. Yeah. Of being able to understand whether it's investors, whether it's your customers, whether it's your employees, whoever it is, you can understand the way they're feeling. And you can change the way you do things because of that. Maybe empathy was the wrong word.
No, that's fine. But there is a range of different qualities that entrepreneurs and founders need to have in order to be successful. What do you think? So this is one thing that's sort of piquing my interest here is that when we're talking about founders, when we're talking about the people themselves going for the funding itself, do you think that perhaps you mentioned before that there might be some kind of bias towards a certain type of founder. Do you think that maybe there might be some things that we can learn? Like, what advice do you have for kind of aspiring entrepreneurs that may not have raised ever before that are like, I am as far as I can take this boat myself and I need to get some funding? You know, what should they first look at?
Yeah, look, so the first thing they should look at is actually, you know, taking a step back and realizing that fundraising is not a short-term thing. It's a long-term goal.
Right.
So the biggest thing I see that founders are failing at is they don't think about it at all until they're 3 months cash out. Oh, cash out means, you know, literally on $0. And they think, oh no, now I need to fundraise. And they don't know what they're doing. And they haven't built anything. They've built relationships, all that kind of stuff. And that's 80-90% of the founders that I see, and the reason why they fail. So they need to take a step back and realize that fundraising is a long-term play. Really? You know, I know people, you know, even founders that I invested into, but then also my clients that I'm working with, and then other founders that I just know, where, you know, their Series A investor, they met 2-3 years before. Who was rejected by them, but they kept a relationship with them for that long. You know, when founders say that I raised in 2 weeks, which is the common, you know, thing, not as much now, but maybe previously.
It's when they break out the eggplant. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, when they summon, so when a founder says, I raised in 2 weeks, they didn't raise in 2 weeks. They did raise that fundraise in 2 weeks, but from people that they raised from, they knew probably for 3 or 4 years. So that's the first one, is you need to build relationships over the long period of time. The second one is you need to, within that kind of sphere, you need to, you know, it's a numbers game and you just need to get as many people within your network. So it's not just about your investors, it's everyone around you, whether that's experts, angels, you know, all other types of, you know, super connectors that are going to be around you that you can actually build warm connections with people. Yeah. And then, you know, when someone says no to you, don't treat it as actually a no, but treat it as an opportunity to carry on a conversation for the next round. You know, a great example of that is a portfolio company. I have forgot the name now. Bought by Many. There we go. I can't remember the CEO's name. I can't, unfortunately. But Bought by Many is now, I believe, worth $4 or $5 billion. They're an insurance business for pets. So yeah, really big company.
Steven Mundell.
There we go. That's his name. Yeah. So Octopus, we rejected him twice.
No shit.
Yeah, I think maybe once or twice. We didn't necessarily. I wasn't there at the time, but we didn't necessarily.
I didn't do it.
You know, believe in him in that stage. But he kept in contact with us. We kept building it. We kept seeing him execute. We kept building that relationship, and then we end up investing into him in the end. Now, if we rejected him first, if he was like, "Oh, they're rejecting me, I'm done."
Yeah.
We would never have invested into him. He would never have got money from us either. And I think he's a very good founder, so I think he still would have been a unicorn founder. But you know, we would never have actually, you know, at least from our point of view, we never would have done that. So you have to really build out that. You know, the common phrase that people say that from, I believe it was from Mark Sister, but I can't remember if that's he coined it or maybe Mark Anderson, is investors invest in lines, not dots. And what that means is investors don't invest on, you know, a single meeting with you or, you know, that single fundraise, really. They invest in multiple touch points. You know, from a sales point of view, it's around 7 touch points. I imagine from fundraising, it's probably closer to 10.
Probably, yeah.
But you need to realize that you need to keep meeting as many people and as many times as possible and build out those relationships so then they can actually trust you rather than being some stranger they have to put money into.
I mean, doesn't it also work on the other side of the, from the other side of the table too? As a founder, allowing an investor into your cap table, bringing them into your company, you know, like, we all focus on like the VC side of things, but as a company owner, it's also, I think, to a certain extent, our responsibility as founders to make sure that the people we bring in are also a good fit. And you can't necessarily do that on like a one-off, a one date, a one drink, a one situation kind of moment. So like, I think the responsibility is shared in that kind of linearity of long-term relationship building.
Yeah, 100% agree with you there. That, you know, another problem with that as well is, you know, which will help you. Again, most founders I see are just not doing this, and that's because they're desperate, right? They just need money and they're really worried about it. But it actually, it doesn't even sound counterintuitive, but, you know, most founders don't do this, is if you actually go in and you say to an investor, look, I care more about, you know, who you are as an investor. I don't necessarily care about the money. I'm building it around the people who are going to help me. Yeah. And then start pushing questions to them as much as that you're there pushing questions to you, it actually will probably increase your chances of getting money from them. Because they, you know, again, they can actually see that this founder is not just, you know, just taking money. They're not just desperate for money. They actually want really good investors that are going to really help their company and really build. And that's another, you know, viewpoint of what most successful founders do, is they don't just care about the money. They care about how are you going to help me build this. So it kind of helps you in both ways as a founder, right? It helps you actually get people who you really believe in, you know, who are going to help you, but then also it probably helps you with your fundraise as well.
Right. Well, on and stuff that you do in your firm, you help people basically become more investable. But do you think it's also fair that some founders have to actually resort to these tactics just to get funding?
No, because look, most founders who don't have to do this, they've probably done a couple of companies before and failed. And that's what happened to me. I failed my first two funding rounds and I learned a lot from what I failed at that point, right? And then obviously my VC side as well. So, you know, if you're a first-time founder and you're paying for something to understand how this works and also to build out, you know, for me, I don't just help founders to be investable from a narrative point of view, but I help them build out a whole operating system behind themselves to actually, you know, prepare, launch, and actually do a fundraise going through it. These are the things that you can't do without failing a fundraise. So you can either, you know, go through and fail a fundraise, or, you know, wing a couple ones if you're lucky. Or you can, you know, actually speak to someone who's done this before and sat on both sides of the table and can help you actually build out how you do this in the most efficient and effective way.
What was the biggest difference between when you fucked up your fundraise to where you're at, what you advise now? What are some of the biggest standouts for you?
Yeah, so it's three things, right? The first one is a long time prep and a strategy behind how you build relationships. So, you know, for me, I always say it's 100 plus investor list with a connected network around you. So what I mean by that is you should have 100 plus investors in your list who you think I want to speak to. You prioritize them in the right way. You have pretty much warm connections to everyone. You have another, let's say 100 to 150 people around that network who are going to give you warm connections, are going to give you, you know, the substantial ability to do that. And, you know, everything is around your network and how you do that. The second one is building actually a narrative and a, you know, storytelling of what makes your offer compelling. And what I mean by that is two things. It's yourself as a founder and your founder brand and your founder story. And then secondly, your company itself and the vision and why your company can be massive and it's VC backable. And, you know, what makes investors actually excited by you. And the third one, which is kind of the foundation of fundraising, is actually building the operating system underneath it that allows you to do the top two, then actually allows you to build out an actual fundraising process, whether that's pre-fundraise, again, 3, 6, 12 months before, whether that's when you're actually launching the fundraise, or whether that's you're actually doing the fundraise and ending on it as well to get, you know, more term sheets. Those are the kind of three pillars that really change someone from being, you know, a founder that's probably not going to fundraise, and then a fundraising founder who actually, you know, is successful and gets multiple term sheets with really great founders, investors rather.
Now that's the second or third time you mentioned this operating system concept. When you say building an operating system around it, what does that mean for you?
This really came from, it came from me, even from my own failed fundraisers, then also, you know, now working for the last 2 years with founders, is I found that the biggest problem with founders fundraising is they don't have two things. They don't have structure of how they do these things. So it's very ad hoc. It's just like, oh, just maybe try this a little bit. It's not like a structured thing of we have to work for this many hours a week on this exact thing, and this is what we're going to do, and this is the process, and I can see how it works. I can see it going through. I can, you know, measure it, etc. And the second one within that as well, which is connected to it, is because you don't have that, founders aren't accountable. They're not doing the thing. They're not connecting with the right people. They're not doing the mindset work. They're not building out how they're doing their clarity. They're just kind of, you know, mulling around, trying to do things. And then that point, they're just looking at the easy, most visual jobs that don't really change anything, like a pitch deck. So they spend all their time on a pitch deck rather than all of the other important stuff they should have done underneath. Usually, you know, the boring and mundane stuff, which is the more important thing than, say, a pitch deck is. So then they just don't do the work.
And so it's boring and mundane. 90%
of the time, the reason why you fail your fundraiser is you just didn't do the work. So that's why you have to build an operating system around yourself so that you are accountable to yourself. You are doing the right stuff. You're doing the boring, mundane stuff. You're building out the network list. You're building out the relationships. You're building out how you're telling your story in the right way. You're building out, you know, your actual timeline of how you launch, et cetera, and what that looks like and the strategy behind that, or, you know, email templates, how you communicate back and forth, et cetera.
Right.
All of these things that, once it gets to a fundraise, it's pretty efficient. It's easy. You've done everything and you've prepared.
Wow. That's pretty, it's pretty comprehensive. So, I mean, from the other side of the table, the VC industry, there's been multiple situations over the last few years that's happened that's kind of shaken it up. Do you think the way it's going now, like right now, that the VC industry is in need of some kind of an awakening or a shakeup, or is it doing all right? Or is it just, is this how it works?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you mean by doing all right, right? The VC industry is the, you know, the backbone of our society now. It you know, creates millions of jobs around the world. It's done amazing innovations and that kind of stuff. So I don't think that's necessarily bad, right? I think VC, for the most part, is doing good in the world. You know, I think study in the UK was like 60% of jobs in the UK are done by VC-backed companies.
Okay.
So look, I don't think VC is necessarily bad in that regard. But yeah, look, it's funny. VCs obviously are investing into innovation, but the VC industry hasn't innovated in 20 years or something, right? Whatever it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there is room for innovation. If I knew what that was, I'd maybe be building it right now. I can't tell you what that is, right? But look, I think there will be something along those lines. Whatever it is, I don't know. You know, great examples of maybe innovation that's going through right now, we'll see how it goes because it's very new, is, you know, revenue-based financing or you know, non-dilutive financing. That's really interesting. You know, from a founder's point of view of being able to, you know, fund themselves. Whether that's going to stand the test of time, I don't know. But yeah, I do think there's opportunities for VC funds to be better. I don't disagree. And you know, I hope it does. I hope there's more, you know, asset classes and abilities for founders to be able to innovate and make better jobs.
What do you mean by revenue-based financing? Is that just like selling shit, making money, being profitable like a business ought to be? Or is this pricing strategy?
I can't pretend I know loads about it. But from what I understand of it, from my very right. simple, my very simplified view of it.
Yeah, I know nothing. That, so you're already ahead.
Yeah. Is that I think your current revenues and then your future potential revenues.
Yeah.
Is based on you get money from that base, basically. And then from your future revenues, once you do actually grow that financing, then you, you know, you'll pay that back.
Okay. Wicked. So then of all the stuff that you've seen and you've been through and everything, you started at 12 wanting to change the world.
Yeah.
Wanting to have a positive impact on the world. Now, looking back at the 12-year-old you versus the, I don't know how old you are now. What's changed and why?
For me, it's actually been not trying to be. I think even from an age of 12, I was trying. You know, it was more of I said that from an external validation point rather than I believed it.
Okay.
So I think I've just become more connected to what I want to do, which is, you know, less about the external validation. I still want to, you know, make a positive impact in the world, but it's not going to be. And I am still technically indirectly, right? With all the companies that I have, you know, helped and invested into in the future, you know, so I'm kind of still indirectly doing that. But for me, it's not going to be, you know, this one thing I'm doing, and I'm, you know, there's, you know, I've got this award or whatever, or you know, I've got this thing that I can say I did exactly this to change the world. For me, it's just, again, maybe a bit more selfish of just I'm passionate about something that I'm doing. I love what I'm doing. I'm be able to build a business around what I want, which is, you know, more time freedom and freedom to do what I want to do. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And you know, indirectly I'm still doing a little bit of, you know, impact in the world, but it's not as much.
When did that shift happen, do you think?
It was during my time as a VC. That was kind of the switch. That's what kind of made my whole world crumble a little bit. It was like, am I doing this for the right reasons? And you know, why do I want to be a VC back founder? Is it actually, do I want to help the world? Like, what do I even have ideas on that? It was all these kind of things that kind of made it. Yeah, that whole kind of worldview of what my goal was kind of crumbled.
So when you finally got a peek behind the Emerald Curtain and saw how the other side of Oz looked and worked, you had that.
I didn't meet them all together. So I probably met, I don't know, let's say, I don't know the exact number, let's say 200 founders, right?
Sure.
All the way from founders who have raised 100 million plus, built unicorn businesses, exited unicorn businesses, all the way to founders that didn't, and all the way in between. And yeah, once you have that kind of viewpoint and you can meet all these people, and unless you're a VC, really, you can't really have that type of experience. You don't really know what successful looks like. And then again, that just came back to me of like, am I that type of person? Probably not. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, you don't have to build a, you know, building a business and is not about being VC backed. It's about, you know, building something for yourself.
Sounds pretty humbling.
Yeah, it was a little bit. It's good. I'm happy about it. I'm happier. I'm much happier doing this than, you know, I wouldn't have been as happy as I am now if I was, you know, in TechCrunch right now, raised a Series A. I don't think. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe I'm wrong there, but
Why is that?
You can never really know.
No, but why is that? What's the big difference?
I think because I would be building it for, again, external validation, not for myself. Right.
And do you think a lot of founders do that? Is there a good amount of founders that go out because they want that check mark next to I raised X hundred whatever?
Yeah, I think a lot of founders do have that kind of chip on their shoulder. And, you know, are trying to just show the world that they're good. And, you know, that's for a lot of founders, that drives a lot of them. But I'm not going to pretend that that makes them happy. You know, a lot of successful people are very unhappy. And I imagine, I know tech CEOs, for example, a lot of them are. You know, mental health in the tech industry is very, very bad. And, you know, I wouldn't put it past, I can't say, I'm not in the heads of all these people, but I wouldn't put it past it that a big reason for a few of them at least, or quite a few of them is this exact thing of they probably were chasing it for external validation rather than I actually really want to build this.
Okay. So I have a bit of an elf in the room that may be a dickish question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. I'm looking right now at this fella's LinkedIn bio. And the first sentence of this LinkedIn bio is, 300 million plus in venture funding raised as a founder, VC, and advisor. Now, is that aligned with the kind of rhetoric that you just talked about?
Yes, because, and you know, I say this all the time on LinkedIn as well, right? 70% plus, I don't know the exact number, but I always say around 70 to 80% of people going for VC money shouldn't be going for VC money. I'm okay with saying that. That's what I believe, right? So I don't want to work with those founders. I want to work with founders that do want to get VC money because they're the ones that are actually really going to change the world, right? They're the ones that are going to innovate and hire thousands of people and, you know, change the way we think about what we're doing in the world. And I still love that. I don't disagree with it. Just because I'm not doing it doesn't mean I don't love it. It's just, I know that's not what I want to do.
That's
cool. So no, I don't think so. And if anything, when fair founders say that to me, I'm like, well, if you're thinking about it, then why are you doing it?
Right.
You shouldn't be doing it. And, you know, it helps both sides, right? For founders, they're not wasting their time on something they don't want to do. And they can, you know, bootstrap a business or go back to 9 to 5, whatever it is. And for the VC side, you know, a lot of the time that VCs, you know, are rude to founders or, you know, not, you know, they don't have a lot of time to always reply to everyone and like specifically why. A lot of the reason why is because 80, 90% of the companies that get sent to them are just not VC backable and they're wasting their time research, you know, looking at these pitch decks. So if that, this will never happen, but if that was reduced, you know, VCs would have more time to focus on the ones that, you know, and reject the ones that actually do make sense. I don't know that will ever change, right? I think that will always happen, but
right,
if in the perfect world that did happen where, you know, 70% of founders currently looking for funding just never did, both sides would be better. And you know, you'd see a higher percentage of founders then fundraise.
So what you're saying is basically 7 out of 10 founders shouldn't be raising, full stop. They should either close shop, focus elsewhere, go to the 9 to 5.
Or bootstrap or get some angels.
Bootstrap.
Don't have to grow, you know, they don't have to grow 2 or 3x every year. Don't have to hire loads of people, you know, and they don't have to, you know, make this like incredibly innovative company. They don't have to, right? And a lot of the times founders who are building companies, they're just like, oh, but I need VC funding because that's what everyone tells me I need to do. But then you look at their company and you're like, you know, you don't, you're not even, you know, you're not going to get the kind of VC scale that a VC wants.
But how are they going to know that?
Well, they won't know that. Yeah. And that's a problem, right? And that is a big problem. There's not enough information in the world and this is not always easy to know. And that's why I say, I don't think it will ever be solved, unfortunately.
Do you think that maybe you discover that by approaching VC funding in the way that you suggested, which is to establish that relationship with the investors first and foremost, and using
if you go do that and you do the right preparation, and you know 9 out of 10 investors that you speak to are saying this is never going to be VC backable or VC scalable, and then you look to yourself and you're like, well, you speak to them and you ask them why, and then they look back and you're like, you know what, maybe they're right, maybe I can't.
Right.
That's true, right? You know, from a VC point of view. Obviously, depending on the stages, but when you want to be a VC-backed company, you've got to really be thinking about Series A plus. Before that is still still VC, right? But then that's money to test if you can get to the point of Series A plus, right? And Series A plus is basically saying that if you give me all of the money, and the Series A really is to test it again to Series B, but let's say Series A is where it starts. is if you give me loads of this money, I've tested everything. All we need to do is hire 2-3x more people and we'll scale in revenue. You just need to give me money and then we can hire the people. And the same thing's going to happen every time to where we scale. And that's how we can scale 2-4x every year. That's the kind of, if you want to simplify what VC scalable is, that's what that is. So a lot of founders, when they look at it, they're probably like, I don't think I am. I don't think I can do that. You know, for example, my business is never going to be VC scalable, right? Or VC backable. And that's because I'm the person who you need every time. So I, it's not like if you give me £1 million today, I can hire 20 of me and then we can keep doing it. It just doesn't work like that. Or, you know, the consumers aren't there as well in terms of the sales channel, et cetera. Whereas, you know, something like, I don't know, Stripe, for example, is just about marketing and getting through and everyone doing it. And you just hire as many people and developers and marketing and sales, et cetera. And that's why they're, you know, literally just, you know, what, I don't know what they're worth now, like 20 or 30 billion plus.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So that's the kind of basis of what a VC backable company is. And if you're not that, then, you know, there's no harm in saying I'm not a VC backable company. It's better if I bootstrap, it's better if I get some angels and then just grow 20% every year and have a lifestyle business. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And so what's your driver behind all of this? Like what motivates you to keep going? And if it's all on your shoulders, there has to be some kind of intrinsic motivation for you that you've clearly said is not external validation. What is the internal driver that keeps you going with helping founders make themselves more investable?
Yeah, it's two things. I love speaking to founders and what they're doing. It was my favorite part of his job as a VC, and it's my favorite part today as well. So what drives me is just being able to meet as many founders as I can, doing everything from, you know, everything from health to fintech to, you know, travel to whatever it is. So that's the first one.
Right.
The second one is I'm just really passionate about how fundraising works, mainly because it's not objective, it's subjective. So for me, I've just been really passionate about how you actually do this in the right manner. Because, you know, it is something, you know, so much is based around perception and so much is based around this kind of stuff that, you know, how can you solve this for as many people as possible? And that's what's really kept me going for the last 2 years, basically. It's just like, how can I know I've pivoted 3 times since, you know, I first started, and, you know, I'm carrying on doing that and I'm, you know, improving every month in terms of what I'm doing. And for me, that's what really drives me. It's like, how can I make everything I do better and better every month? And, you know, we're doing that, which is what matters.
And what do you think founders are getting wrong?
I said it before, right? It's those kind of 3 pillars, and not doing the work.
Wicked. And so what's next? What's like, just you may have the English accent, but where are you right now? Like, where with, like, you can pretty much do this from wherever, this kind of advisory.
Yeah,
services.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm currently in sunny Thailand in a place called Koh Samui. I'm traveling around a lot at the moment, but I don't really like traveling around a lot, to be honest with you. So I'm trying to find a base. I don't know where it is. I know it's not England anymore. I just don't know where it is. Hopefully in the next 6 months, that's a, you know,
why isn't it in England?
Where I am, and this is where I'm staying, because I definitely know I need a base now. I want to have, like, you know, my own setup and, you know, my own lease, and it's my place with my own, you know, everything. I'm kind of done with, you know, living out of hotels, but. I can live anywhere in the world. And that, again, that was one of the reasons why I am building the company, because that was one of the things I wanted, right? Was for me to be able to say, I'm just going to go live here if I want to, or, you know, I can take this time off if I want. Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to build around.
Why not the UK? A
couple of things. I love the UK. Don't get me wrong. Family and friends are very important. And that's the biggest thing I miss.
Yeah.
But for me, it's the... I'm very sad in the UK, especially in the winter. I love the summer for like 3 months, but as soon as it starts getting dark and cold and rainy, I just can't do it. I think I just need vitamin D in me. I think I think I need the sun on my face, even if it's, yeah. So that, for me, that's the big one.
So it's just weather. The rest of the UK is all right. Cause like, it's a huge, from what you were talking about in terms of the kinds of things that people need to do to really build that successful business, to create that network, to get the connectors going. The UK is huge for that. Is there the stuff that you train, can that be location agnostic? Can you do that in places where there might not be networks? Like, what if someone...
Yes, yes and no. I mean, with Zoom now, like what we're doing right now, and, you know, on a Zoom call, you can, right, for the most part. And, you know, founders have got funding from investors from halfway across the world just from a Zoom call. So you definitely can.
Okay.
But, you know, I think you do it again from a VC. And this is another thing why I didn't want to be a VC backed founder, right? And like I said, I can be location independent or, you know, go where I want to go. When you're a VC backed founder, you can't do that, right? If you're, you know, if your major sales are going to be in the UK or if your major sales are going to be in the US, you know, a lot of our founders from the UK who, you know, end up moving to the US to, you know, scale their companies there.
Yeah.
So you have to do that, right? And you won't be able to change that. So if, you know, if you want to be a VC-backed founder and you think, you know, we're going to really scale in the UK or we're going to really scale in the US, then you have to think about going there. And then at that point, once you are there, then you can actually start to build relationships in person. And in person is always better. As much as it's amazing that we can talk right now, you'll always build bigger connections when you're actually face-to-face with someone. And you can, right. You know, you can see, you can actually look into their eyeballs freaking, you know, straightforward.
Yeah.
That's always going to be more powerful. I'm not going to say no to that. So for VC, for my clients and my VC backed founders that I'm working with, you know, I always say, yeah, try and get as many in-person meetings as you can, you know, get them to come to your office, get them to, you know, get to go to their offices, actually meet them for a coffee. It's so much better than just jumping on a Zoom call, even though a Zoom call is easier.
Now, if there's anyone out there listening that wants to learn more about some of the stuff that you're working on or some of the things that you're doing, or maybe even some of the materials that you might have consumed that have helped you along the way, like books or sites or whatnot, what would you suggest?
Yeah, so I write on LinkedIn every day about fundraising. So you can just go on my LinkedIn profile, Gian Sehra. So GianSehra.
I'll put a link to it.
Oh, I put a link. Okay, brilliant. Yeah, so you can go on my LinkedIn. I write there every day about fundraising. So that's probably the easiest free resource you can get from it. Apart from that, if you want to really understand how a VC thinks about deals, there's a multitude of different ways you can do that. One is I've got a free investment committee paper on my newsletter when you sign up. So you can literally see how they actually decide how from a company. There's also a book called Venture Deals, which is mainly for actually VCs, but it's a great one for actually understanding. Yep, that's a really good one.
Yeah.
And then otherwise, it's really, if you want to learn a little bit more about this kind of stuff, it's just enticing yourself with VCs. It's speaking to VCs. It's, you know, going onto VC industry blogs, all this kind of stuff. But the best one is just meeting as many people as you can, having conversations with them. And that's the best way to learn.
Amazing. Before we go, I wanted to just check, what do you think? This question just came to me. So I'm kind of curious. How do you disqualify a VC? Because we've been talking about the other side. You know what I mean? We've been talking about VCs disqualifying investors.
It's a hard one. There's a few ways. It's all about asking questions about how they're going to help you, right? So that's the first one, is how much are you actually going to help me? What, you know, are you just going to give me money and leave me alone? Like, what does that look like? You know, when you come on my board, how connected are you going to be? If you leave, what does that look like? All of these kind of questions of, okay, once you actually get investment, what are you going to be with me? Are you going to actually help me build my company or not? And then you should be looking for, you know, investors that you care about. The second one, which goes both ways, is, do I like this person? Like, can I spend the next 10 years with this person on my board, or like me having to text them on WhatsApp every time? Or if something bad happens, do I trust them? That goes both ways. And the third one, which you don't really get to until you get to a term sheet, is, are they giving me good terms, right? You know, is this investor coming to me with really bad terms, either from a valuation point of view or from, I'm not going to get too technical, but, you know, all of the kind of bad terms that, you know, can really destroy you as a founder, and they're not budging on those. If that happens, then yeah, you should definitely be like, look, it's not working, because it shouldn't be about getting better terms. It should be about, I really believe in your company and your vision, and I want to join you and help you doing that. So I would say those three are the main ones. There's probably a few others I'm forgetting about, but those are the three main ones.
Yeah, that reminds me of a quick anecdote told to me by one of my old professors. He negotiated NAFTA, Derek Burney. And in the middle of negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement, he basically walked away from the agreement. And he said that was actually the biggest, at one point, the agreement eventually took place, but in any negotiation that you have, you need to always be prepared to walk away from the table, to not be crazy committed. So I think that speaks to what you mentioned at the beginning, is that sometimes when you go in, not desperate for money, but when you go in having zero money in your bank account, seeking investment, it's harder to walk away from the table from an investor, despite the terrible terms, despite situations that will cripple you in the long run. And so that self-awareness, which you mentioned as well, that sort of EQ, if you will, about whether or not you can withstand that kind of relationship becomes even more salient, even more important in these kinds of situations. So it's you really need to have a hard look at yourself and say, you know, this just doesn't work, and be able to step aside and maybe say, maybe you as a founder need to say, well, shit, this is not right now for me. You know, so it's an interesting, we always look at it from the VC side of things, like a founder going for other people's money, VC money, that kind of stuff. Not that much attention is paid to founders and their self-awareness, I guess, which is an interesting
100%. And again, this is the stuff, right, where you can understand why a VC thinks that, right? If a founder is not done their finances right, and they're, you know, 2 months cash out, and now they're desperate, it looks bad on them. That's a bad founder as well, right? But right. If they spend 12 months building relationships, and they know, look, these are the three investors I love, and those investors say, you're like 6 months cash out, I've been knowing you for 12 months, when are you fundraising? That's the secret behind fundraising, is not even you going out. It's, I've built relationships over a long period of time that investors are coming to me and saying, when have you, you know, you haven't fundraised in a year and a half. Like, when are you fundraising in? I want to get into the next round. That's where you really win.
Nice. Well, I don't want to take too much of your time, but this has been a really enlightening conversation. It mirrors a lot of the great content that you share on LinkedIn that I love consuming. You post a lot of really great stuff on there. Are there any other channels or ways that people can get in touch with you or learn from you?
LinkedIn is definitely the first way, and that's the best way. I post on there once a week as well about my newsletter, which is a little bit of a deeper dive. There's one actionable tip a week on that.
Nice.
So those are the two main ones, but I would always say just start with my LinkedIn, and then as you know read more of it, then you can delve deeper into the newsletter.
Sweet. Well, Jan, thank you so much for taking the time today. Really appreciate it. I look forward to learning more from you over time and connecting with you, or connecting you to other peeps and stuff. So that's this has been a really cool call, a really cool chat. I hate you because you are staring at the beautiful sun while I have to wear a jacket to go outside and you're in shorts. But that aside, love this chat. So thanks again, man.
Thanks so much, Michael. Yeah, this has been an amazing chat. Thank you.
Brilliant. Speak to you soon, brother.
See ya.